Welcome, everyone, to the new Scuttlebutt podcast. This is an evolution of our original Scuttlebutt podcast, whereas now we're going to take our live Monday night Zoom programs and we're going to release them in audio format. We're going to edit them slightly for clarity. Sometimes you will hear myself, Sean Hall, as the host. Other times you may hear the executive director, Todd DiBastino, hosting, or even Glenn Flickinger, who is also a host with the VBC. If you tend to miss our Monday night Zoom programs, it's a great place to find us. We're excited about this new direction for the Scuttlebutt, as we always have amazing guests and interesting stories happening on Monday nights. So if you miss us on Monday night, feel free to download this as the podcast moving forward. In this episode, I talk with Bob Orcand. He is the co-author of Misfire, the Tragic Failure of the M16 in Vietnam. We dive into some history about Vietnam and eventually get to what happened with the M16 rifle. Bob was a very knowledgeable guest, and we had a great time speaking with him. And if you have any thoughts or comments or questions, you can always reach out to us at Sean, S-H-A-U-N, at veteransbreakfastclub.org. Thank you so much for supporting the VBC, and please visit our website, www.veteransbreakfastclub.org. On there, you can find out what we have upcoming for online events, our in-person breakfast in and around the Pittsburgh region. You can sign up to become a member. You can sign up to get our free quarterly magazine, check out our blog, listen to our podcast, many different ways to engage with the VBC. Thank you so much again and enjoy the show.
I was drafted and went to Fort Dix, New Jersey for basic combat training. Nothing distinguished there, but while we were there, I got the orientation on infantry on officer candidate school. My first Thanksgiving in the Army, Thanksgiving Day 1954, I caught KP duty. Not a good day to be KP because on Thanksgiving Day, the Army has a traditional open house and invites friends, family, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, everything of that sort. And I was on KP. And on KP, kitchen police, I caught the worst duty of all, which was cleaning the roast turkey pots and pans, scrubbing them not with Dawn detergent. The Army didn't believe in Dawn detergent. The Army used bars of lye soap. And by 5 in the morning, my fingers were bleeding from the lye. I had over my slop sink a little window, and I could clean it off with my hand to clean the fog off and see the trainees arriving with their families waiting outside. And I said to myself, the heck with this noise. If I'm going to spend 2 years in the Army, I don't want to spend it doing this. So having received the officer candidate school orientation, the next Monday I knocked at the orderly room door and said, the first sergeant said, what do you want, private? And I said, I want to apply for OCS. He laughed at me. I was 6 feet tall, 20 years old, weighed 154 pounds, and a most unlikely looking candidate to be a second lieutenant. He laughed at me, but the company commander gave me the papers and I filled out my application. And lo and behold, I applied for artillery OCS. And lo and behold, a couple of months later, I was en route to Fort Benning, Georgia, now renamed, as you know, Fort Moore for Hal Moore. And we'll talk about Hal Moore a little bit later on in the book. We were soldiers, and the movie as well. I want to talk about those. So there I am, infantry officer, candidate school, and going through it and doing rather well. And as we filled out our application, I said, I'd like to go to Europe. So I put my preference statement for Europe, and instead I got Korea. And I ended up with the 17th Infantry Regiment, no shooting going on. And I ended up with the 17th Infantry Regiment, a part of the 7th Infantry Division. We were the furthest north U.S. unit. When I tell people that I spent 16 months north of the demilitarized, north of the 38th parallel of latitude, they look at me as if I was behind enemy lines. People do not realize that although the Korean War broke out in 1950 along the 38th parallel, it ended in 1953 at the demilitarized zone, which is below the 38th parallel in the west and 20 or 25 miles above in the eastern part of Korea. So there I was with the 17th Infantry Regiment, teaching a heavy mortar company, a platoon leader in the heavy mortar company, teaching classes on heavy mortar gunnery to my troops sitting in the snow. We had no classroom, we were living in tents. One third of my troops were Katusas, Korean augmentations to the United States Army, two thirds were GIs. They're sitting there in the snow and I'm teaching them the principles of heavy mortar gunnery and the like. And while I was doing that, I came to realize I have a little flair for leadership. I'd never discovered this in myself. As I said, I was a kid coming into Columbia, let me in a little bit early because, you know, and the like. So while I was there, there was a program. So I'm a second lieutenant in the Army Reserves on active duty. And the Army has a regular Army augmentation. It's going to expand the size of the small hardcore of the Army around which it expands in time of national emergency. And when I got my next assignment to Fort Ord, California, I was integrated into the regular Army. Nothing goes smoothly for me. About 2 months at Fort Ord, I was a platoon leader in a basic training company. About 2 months there, I got a word that the regimental commander wanted to see me. And Colonel Aloysius C. McCormick looked me in the eye and he said, "Orkan, I see you've been a first lieutenant, you've been a second lieutenant for 22 months. The normal time for promotion from second lieutenant to first lieutenant is 18 months. Did anything happen in Korea which kind of derailed your career?" I said, "No, sir, I did fine." So they sent a TWIX off. A TWIX was a military telegram to 7th Infantry Division, and got a TWIX back that my DA Form 78 on me had been sent, not received by, but DA finally said, after a TWIX to DA, officer highly qualified for promotion to first lieutenant at this time, provided you have no objection, issue appropriate orders promoting him to first lieutenant. Yeah, backdated my date of rank, but didn't give me the increase in pay. And boy, that increase in pay to first lieutenant, was worth something like $50 a month instead of three, to bring it up to $335 a month, the base pay for a first lieutenant in 1957. Anyway, I was then a member of the regular Army, back from Korea. I didn't have my college degree because I'd been drafted in the final, but the Army had a program called Operation Bootstrap, final semester plan. And they let you go back to college at your own expense, of course, to complete it. And I went back to Columbia and got my degree, came back to Fort Ord, and they made me an adjutant at the training regiment. And one day I got word that the post commander at Fort Ord, Major General Breckinridge, ordered to go to Korea as chief of staff of the 8th U.S. Army. And he was looking for an officer who had been in Korea, a junior officer who had been to Korea, to accompany him to camp. I talked it over with my wife, who was pregnant at the time with our first child. And we decided that one way to get out of debt, because I'd incurred considerable debts going back to college at my own expense, one way to get out of debt was to go to Korea where I could live on absolutely nothing. And I was accepted as general's aide, and I became his aide. He was chief of staff of 8th Army, and I was his aide for the whole time. Not a difficult assignment. And that's how my military career got started. I was, in effect, an accidental, because I was drafted, because I was OCS, because I decided to apply for the regular Army even after my date of rank, even after I lost my promotion to first lieutenant. Everything seemed to be going against me. Lo and behold, I ended up being an accidental officer, spent 20 months, and fought the Cold War from just about every vantage point you could think of. For two assignments in Korea, Vietnam, of course, we'll talk about that, on the staff of the U.S. Command of Berlin. General Breckinridge, after Korea, became chief of the Army Security Agency, the Army component of the National Security Agency. Many people don't realize it, but each of the services feeds intelligence information into the NSA computers, those big gray computers at Fort Meade, Maryland. And with ASA, we had listening posts on Shemya Island in the far Aleutians. We visited that. On the Black Sea coast, Sinop, Turkey, we visited that. In Asmara, Eritrea, in Cairo, Egypt, my son was born while the general and I were in Cairo, Egypt, visiting the embassy where we had listening devices underneath the rooftop of the embassy. And I participated in the volunteer army as executive officer of the experimental 197th Infantry Brigade at Benning, again now Moore, commanded a mechanized infantry battalion at Benning for 18 months. Became the first Pentagon spokesman on the volunteer army in 1974, was spokesman for Army Chief of Staff General Abrams for his illness and death in 1974, participated. We flew our battalion from Fort Carson, Colorado to Washington, D.C. to help pull down the riots in April in 1968 when MLK was assassinated. And I look back on those 20 years. I've been out of the Army now for 50 years, but I look back on those 20 years, good days, bad days, cold days, hot days, as the best years of my life. I beat it. Sean, that's about what my background consists of.
In a nutshell, wow. And it's an incredible, we're going to dive, a bit more into that as we go along here in bits and pieces. But what we want to do is before we get to Misfire, we want to talk a bit about your co-author, Lyman. And Lyman passed away, was right before this book was published. And I thought you might want to say, say some remembrance about him.
I had planned, I wanted to write a book. I published, while I was editor and publisher of Infantry Magazine at Benning, I published the book, A Distant Challenge, putting together narratives of people who'd been there in the early days of Vietnam, so forth like that. Printed 5,000 copies, sold 5,000 copies, and did very, very well. The book was later plagiarized. Don't buy it on eBay because the book that's offered for sale is the plagiarized version. And I wanted to write a follow-on book. So I contacted a publisher right there in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, over in the Harrisburg area, not far from Sean, where you are, Sean. And I proposed a book on the My Lai Massacre. I was not involved in the My Lai Massacre. I was in Vietnam about 2 months before that happened, in March of 1968. But I had a peripheral experience in many, many ways. For example, one day, the assistant commandant of the infantry school, Colonel Earl Acuff, came down the stairs from the sixth floor to the fifth floor of infantry hall in a state of near panic. And this was a guy who wore the combat infantryman badge with 2 stars. He'd been a combat infantryman in 3 wars and a master pilot. Went through the Ranger School when he was 47 years old, so he didn't panic easily. And Earl Acuff says, "Bob, who's the best writer we have here at the infantry school?" I wanted to say, "Sir, you're looking at the best writer at the infantry school. I was sent here from the command and general's class at Fort Benning to be the next editor of Infantry Magazine. You're looking at the best writer." But I knew he didn't want me. He didn't want to deter me from that assignment. I came up with the name. I said, Dewey Cameron. Lieutenant Colonel Dwayne Cameron, a native Pennsylvanian, by the way, was head of the leadership department, which also taught military writing. And Dewey Cameron became what the military calls an Article 32 investigating officer. An Article 32 officer under the Uniform Code of Military Justice is like a grand jury in civilian life. And based on that Article 32 investigation, Lieutenant William Laws Calley Jr. was charged and ultimately convicted with the murder of more than 20 noncombatants in the village, the hamlet of My Lai 4. Many more people, of course, were killed that day, but Kelly was personally charged with the murder of them. And I also knew in Vietnam the commander of the Mirakal Division, Major General Custer, commanding officer of the division, who helped orchestrate the cover-up of the My Lai Massacre. Custer would fly in his Charlie command and control helicopter into my TAC on landing zone Baldy several times a week, and ask for map briefings on what our units, what our companies were doing. And I would brief him, and sometimes his assistant division commander would brief him on what we were doing. And I realized after a while that he was using our experiences in the first CAV, and of course we pioneered the air mobile combat assault capabilities. He was using it to teach his units in the new AmeriCal division how to do combat assaulting. All right, a Stackpole book said, "We don't want a book on My Lai. How about a we've got too much has already been written about it. How about a book on helicopter operations? I don't know anything about helicopter operations. I know how to ride in a helicopter. I know how to direct an operation from a helicopter, but I don't know anything about helicopter operation." And finally, I came up with the concept, and I said, "How about a book on the M16 rifle and the problems that it experienced?" We experienced with the M60 in Vietnam. And that got the attention of my editor. My problem was that even though I knew a great deal about the M16, I'd been, after all, deputy director of the weapons department at the infantry school at one point, but I'm not a weapons buff. I don't know the fine to, I know how to deploy an M16. I know how to fire it and use it and such, but I don't know the inner workings. I needed somebody who could work with me. I had a neighbor and a close associate, a friend, who was the retired sheriff of Conroe, Texas, a fast-growing community a little bit south of here in Huntsville, Texas, between Huntsville and Houston to the south. John Linden was his name. He knew everything about weapons, former sheriff, of course, had a magnificent library of military weapon books, had a magnificent collection of guns. And so, John, I said, will you co-author a book with me? I need somebody to backstop me. John says, I sure will. And lo and behold, I reported that to Stackpole, and we were, lo and behold, a week later, John backed off. He had too many commitments, and I was left without a co-author. I had a commitment from Stackpole to write, and I couldn't do it by myself. God works in mysterious ways, does he not? One of my sayings is, life is what happens to you when you're looking the other way. Happened to me in all of my life. Lo and behold, a few weeks later, comes a letter from someone in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I don't know anybody in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It turned out that it was one of my former ROTC cadets in Rockford, Illinois, where I had been assigned after completing the infantry officer career course at Benning. And Vern Miller wrote me a letter, and I wrote back. I lost track with him, and he wrote that he had served in the 1st Cav Division as an enlisted man, as an infant in the 2nd of the 7th Battalion, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. And I told him in a follow-up letter or email, I told him my dilemma that I needed somebody to write help me co-write a book. And he sent word back, hey, my company commander in Vietnam, Captain Lyman Duryea, participated in the testing of the AR-15 when it was being evaluated against the AK-47 and the M14E2, the automatic rifle version, the automatic version of the Army's then standard M14 rifle. And so I said, boy, put me in touch with him. So Vern Miller put me in touch with Lyman, middle name Chandler, and he likes the nickname Chan, so I'm going to call him Chan Duryea, living in McDaniels, Kentucky. And through emails, we proposed writing the book, and he agreed. We had two face-to-face meetings over the next year and a half, once in Atlanta and once in Fort Hood, Texas, where the 1st Cav Division, now an armored division, is headquartered. And over the rest of the time, we communicated by email, snail mail, phone, and the like. And some members of his family are with us tonight. I'm very, very proud to see. Okay. Chen's background. A West Pointer. A man, if there ever was such a thing as a Renaissance man, it is Chan Duryea. A master of languages. Spoke Spanish, spoke French, translated a book about the 1st Cav in Vietnam from the French into the English language, commanded a rifle company, Charlie Company of the 2nd and the 7th Cav in Vietnam in 1966 and 1967, earned a Silver Star, Combat Infantryman Badge, Silver Star, later defense attaché to El Salvador, taught English and French at West Point, got a PhD from Temple University. I mean, a man of letters, languages, and active in all kinds of outdoor activities, scuba diving, kayaking, hiking the Appalachian Trail, on his way to a snow skiing trip to Colorado, as we were nearing completion of the book, and got very sick and turned back home and was diagnosed with a stage 4 cancer that killed him about a month short of his 81st birthday. Just, we were in final production on the week. I mean, he'd done everything that needed to be done. All I was doing was proofing the final copy and making final thing. Chan had written the dedication to the book, and the dedication of the book was, to all who served. We had agreed that he would write the dedication. And upon his death, I got permission from his family to rededicate the book to him. And therefore, the book was finally dedicated to him. And I had just enough time to update reference to him, biographical material and stuff like that, to the poet past tense rather than the present tense. In other words, not he lives in McDaniels, Kentucky, but he lived in McDaniel, Kentucky. Without Chan and without Vern Miller, who put me in touch with Chan, this book would never have been written. It's now in its second printing. The book, the version that Sean has held up is the paperback edition, which Stackpole did last year. The original hardback edition was published in 2019. Sean, that covers how the book came to be written.
And I will put into the chat here a link to the book on Amazon for everyone. And you should definitely give it a read. It's meticulously reported on, an incredible history. And something you should know, just if you click on that link that I put into the chat, you can get the hardcover book right now on Amazon. I think they're running a 20% off coupon, and the hardcover is a little different than the paperback, but you get pictures. And if you use the coupon, you get it for the same price, I believe, as the paperback. So, Bob, how did you begin to write this? As we talked a bit about in the beginning, that, you know, the soup here is very messy. And how did you start to make sense of all of this and understand, you know, where the M16 came from, the story of how it was such a tragedy?
From the beginning, Chan and I agreed that we wanted it to be more than just a gun book. We wanted the M16 to be a microcosm, and the bad decision-making with respect to the M16, the bad decision-making with respect to its development and commitment into combat before it was totally unready, with the wrong ammunition being sent with it. And we'll get into that a little bit later on, of course, and so on. So we wanted the book to show that the microcosm, that the M16 was a microcosm for all of the poor, muddle-headed decision-making done by too many members of the White House, the Secretary of Defense Office, and General Westmoreland himself in Vietnam, that there was failure. So we began the book with President Kennedy's inauguration, January 20th of 1960, so forth like that. Because Kennedy, although we don't think of him as being very much involved, when Kennedy became president, there were 900, they weren't called quite special forces, they weren't Green Berets, but they were special forces. There were 900 advisors under the legendary colonel, name escapes me at the moment, Bull Simons, Arthur Bull Simons, in the Laos. And by the time Kennedy was assassinated 1,037 days later, there were 16,000 U.S. military personnel in Southeast Asia, not U.S. military, not army forces, not regular army forces, but special forces guys, advisors, military advisory group Vietnam, and helicopter pilots who were flying the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam troops around in their helicopters, Chinook helicopters, some Hueys, and the like. So Kennedy gets a lot of responsibility for involving us in Vietnam, responsibility which the media is largely unwilling to accept. They portray an image of Kennedy as and his 1,000 days in office before he was assassinated as Camelot, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the popular culture about that time when we get to a slideshow.
Well, Bob, yeah, let's get to that slideshow here. Hold on one second. I want to bring up a picture of you back at this time here. It may, maybe it wouldn't surprise everyone, but you sure are a dashing young guy here.
This is me at 26 years old. I'm a first lieutenant. I'm aide-de-camp to General Breckinridge. We're off to someplace, Turkey or Asmara, Eritrea, something like that. And I need to get a passport. So that's my passport photo.
So we have that. I know we have a couple slides here. We talked about this in fire. This is Vernon Miller.
Okay, let's go to the next one, please.
All right. Yep, there we go.
I'm a little bit, can we go, this is Chan in Vietnam. I'm a little bit further down than I would like to. Yeah, that's a good place to start. That's a good place to start. This LP, the musical Camelot, was Kennedy's, as the slide indicates, his favorite musical. Jackie Kennedy says that he listened every evening to that LP, and the song itself, Camelot, a law was passed a distant while ago here, July and August can't be too hot. Jackie said he listened to it just about every time. And the beauty of Jackie Kennedy, the handsome young husband, 43 years old, our youngest chief executive, David Icke, who at that time at 70 when he left office was the oldest chief executive. Our chief executives have aged a lot since Icke's day, that's for sure. And the country was like Camelot and a beautiful dream, and it all came crashing down in a sense when Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in November of 1963. Okay, next slide, please. That's the widow, Jackie Kennedy, on the steps of the Capitol, her husband's death. The old guard, the Army, the 3rd Infantry there, standing guard. Her two children, John Jr., John John as he was known, tragically killed when he was piloting a small aircraft and apparently lost the perspective and ended up flying upside down. And daughter Carolyn, who most recently has been American ambassador to Tokyo and is now U.S. ambassador to Australia. And the tragedy, beautiful Jacqueline Kennedy, and the tragic death of her husband. Next slide, please, Sean. Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy's vice president, acceded to president of the United States upon Kennedy's death. Took the oath of office as president aboard the Boeing 707. Right behind them was the casket carrying dead President Kennedy, had been pronounced dead at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, and waiting for Jackie. And somebody in the traveling party said, "We are without a president of the United States. We need to swear in the new president." And somebody said, "Is there a judge aboard?" And there happened to be little Sarah Hughes, a judge from Dallas, happened to be hopping a hop to Washington, D.C. And she said, "I can swear in the new president." And LBJ became president under those very difficult conditions. LBJ could have been one of our great presidents of all time. Matter of fact, some scholars list him as the 10th greatest president of all time, despite all of the wrong-headed decisions he made with respect to Vietnam. And we'll talk about that. Let's go, Sean, to the next slide, please. LBJ was torn between wanting guns and butter, I'll explain that in a minute, and his vision of the great society. LBJ wanted to have it both ways when he was president of the United States. He wanted to fight the necessary war in Vietnam, which didn't realize, of course, how much it would escalate beginning in 1965. But Kennedy, after all, had left 16,000 U.S. American advisors and special forces people over there and so forth. And LBJ wanted to have to fight a war in Southeast Asia and have butter on tables for all Americans. In other words, he wanted to fight a war without really acknowledging that we were at war. He should have, in retrospect, and of course, in retrospect, everything becomes clearer, he should have mobilized the reserves. That's what all of our contingency plans in that time called for, that if we went to war, the reserves should be called up. But LBJ didn't want to do that because that would acknowledge that our nation was really at war and would interfere with what LBJ thought as his great society. LBJ left behind a record of civil rights that is unrivaled in time. The Voting Rights Act, War on Poverty, the start of the Head Start program, the start of better housing opportunity, just a marvelous, marvelous record. LBJ, of course, had been a congressman and a senator. The new book by Robert Caro, continuing biography of LBJ, calls him Master of the Senate, and that he was. He got things done. He knew how to manipulate. He knew how to make deals and everything like that. Unfortunately, he really didn't know how to fight a war without infringing. He thought that his great society would be jeopardized by the American public turning its attention too much to the war and by wanting too much guns and not enough butter. We had the Soviet threat going on, not only the same time fighting a war in Vietnam, but the Soviet threat in the 1960s. I was on the staff of the U.S. Command of Berlin in 1965 and 1966. LBJ came over to visit with the U.S. Army Europe headquarters in Heidelberg, and he told the four-star general, Andy McClatt, he told him, whatever happens, don't rock the boat with the effing Russians in Berlin. I'm fighting a war on the other side of the globe, and I can't afford a second war with the Russians over Berlin. And in the 1968 election, LBJ was overwhelmingly elected, swept just about, I think, won every state except Massachusetts, and just overwhelmingly defeated Barry Goldwater and the Republican opposition. And as my slide says, he left office in 1961. He died at his ranch in Johnson City, Texas, in the hill country of Texas, a broken man, died of a heart attack. And he was only age 64. He wasn't even fully eligible for Social Security at that particular time. It did not turn out right. He could have been, should have been one of our greatest presidents, but he made the wrong decisions with respect to Vietnam. And he wasn't the only one. We'll go on. And who's our next one? Robert McNamara became Secretary of Defense when Kennedy took office. McNamara was an Air Force, U.S. Air Force, lieutenant colonel, not a pilot, a systems analyst during World War II, did some brilliant work in programming, an early exponent of ORSA, Operations Research System Analysis, and became president of the Ford Motor Company, the first non-Ford, non-member of the Ford family to head Ford since early in the 20th century. He'd been on the job as president of Ford for about 7 weeks when one day he got a phone call from Bobby Kennedy, younger brother of President-elect Kennedy and soon to be Attorney General of the United States. Bobby Kennedy came quickly to the point. He said, the president-elect, meaning, of course, Jack Kennedy, would be very grateful if you would meet with our brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver. And didn't tell him why. It didn't tell McNamara why. Sergeant Shriver had married Kennedy's sister, Eunice Kennedy. Helped found the police corps, job corps, the Peace Corps, and the Head Start program, and the like. The next afternoon, Sergeant Shriver called on McNamara at his Ford Motor Company headquarters in Dearborn, Michigan. And Shriver said, on behalf of the president-elect, I'm authorized to offer you the position of Secretary of the Treasury. McNamara's background lent itself to that kind of analysis, nitpicking and money things and that kind of thing that he'd done in the Air Force under Operations Research and System Analysis. McNamara said, no, I don't think I'm qualified for that. Shriver said, in that case, I am authorized to offer you the position of Secretary of Defense. McNamara said, no, I don't know the difference between a station wagon and a guided missile. And at that point, Shriver said, then please meet with the president-elect tomorrow. And McNamara flew to Washington, visited with Kennedy at his mansion in Georgetown. And McNamara said, I'm not qualified. And Kennedy said, Bob, there's no manual on how to be a good president either. And for the next 7.5 years, McNamara served as Secretary of Defense longer than anybody before or since, and made terrible, terrible decisions with respect to the M16 rifle, the so-called TFX-111 fighter plane, and all kinds of budget-conscious, nitpicking decisions, cutting the size of our armed forces in between the war and the like. So my first villain with respect to the wrong decision-making in Vietnam is Lyndon Baron Johnson. The second one is Robert McNamara. And let's go to the third one, please, Sean. General William Westmoreland comes home, brought home by LBJ in April of 1967 to address a joint session of Congress. That is Vice President Hubert Humphrey to Westmoreland's right, and that is Speaker of the House John McCormick of Massachusetts behind Westmoreland, above him and to his right. Westmoreland gets a standing ovation from Congress, and he tells Congress with respect to the respect to Vietnam, we are winning the war, and we are grinding the enemy down. What Westmoreland didn't realize that by grinding him down, he was advocating a policy of attrition, wearing the enemy down. And Ho Chi Minh and General Giap, his military commander, did not care how many North Vietnamese and how many Viet Cong were lost. What they wanted to do was to address the fact that the days of Western colonialism in Indochina were over and done, the French were gone, and the United States and Western allies were not going to take over. So Westmoreland, by foolishly waging a war of attrition, by refusing to equip the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, with the new M16 rifle, and forcing them to fight with M1 rifles and the old M2 carbine from World War II days, was handicapping them in their ability to fight against the Viet Cong, that is before the North Vietnamese came into the army. Westmoreland made all kinds of wrong-headed decisions that weren't corrected until he left Vietnam in 1972 in 1968 and turned the leadership of Military Assistant Command Vietnam over to General Abrams, who held it then until 1972. Let's go to the next slide, please. Let's talk now about some of the popular culture with respect to Vietnam. We know now that historians say that Vietnam was a terrible disaster, that it was a quagmire, that it was a defeat for the United States. That's the way historians have recorded it, that it divided our country terribly, called all kinds of riots and the like. And I'm going to try and show you that it did not start out that way and didn't have to be that way. Robin Moore was something of an adventurer who in 1965 wrote this book, The Green Berets, a fictionalized account of actual Green Beret operations. Moore was something of a hustler. He was a Harvard classmate of Bobby Kennedy, President Kennedy's younger brother, and persuaded Bobby Kennedy to use his influence to let Moore go to Vietnam to accompany the 7th Special Forces Group when it was deployed there in 1963, and 1963 primarily. Moore wrote this book, The Green Berets. As you can see, it became a bestseller with 4 million copies sold. People snapped it up. Kennedy had been an enthusiastic supporter of the Green Berets. Matter of fact, it was Kennedy himself who awarded the Green Beret. He came to Fort Bragg, in North Carolina, since renamed Fort Liberty. He came there, and Brigadier General Yarbrough, the post commander, showed him a Green Beret and said, Mr. President, we need to be acknowledged for a special all-purpose mission, and we'd like you to authorize the Green Beret. And a few months later, they became the Green Berets. So this is a book which triggers several other action as a result. Can we have the next slide, please? In 1966, this song,
I'm told to the song of the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, of brave men of the rainbow ray, fill me upon their chest. These are men.
Sergeant Barry Sadler, in collaboration with our friend Robin Moore, wrote this song. Robin Moore helped him out with the lyrics. Robin Moore, as you can see, the 45 RPM was done, not quite yet. Yeah, yep. Was done by RCA, and Robin Moore had the entree to RCA to get it recorded. Barry Sadler performed the song on Ed Sullivan's Sunday night show, the Ed Sullivan Show, which was probably the most popular song and most popular television show in America. Every Sunday evening at 8 p.m., America stopped and watched the Ed Sullivan Show. That's where the Beatles made their U.S. debut. That's where Elvis made his U.S. debut. And Barry Sandler sang the song, Ballad of the Green Berets, on the Ed Sullivan Show. And for six straight weeks in 1966, it was number one on the hit parade. Next slide, please, Sean. Robin Moore's book, The Green Berets, became a John Wayne movie, The Green Berets. There's John Wayne, the director, directed himself, playing the colonel who leads Green Beret missions into North Vietnam, kidnaps a North Vietnamese general. The movie was universally panned. Roger Ebert gave it zero stars. It really was a bad movie, but it made a lot of money. People were interested in seeing it and the like. Made just a ton of money and the like. John Wayne was old. It was much too heavy set. But anyway, I'm trying to show that in the early days, the movie was shot in the summer of 1967 at Fort Benning. John Wayne used his influence with the Kennedy administration to get the Army to cooperate, and the Army provided helicopters, background soldiers on the Rangers at Fort Benning, part of the popular culture, and people went to see the movie. Even if it wasn't much of a show. So what I'm trying to show in this series of slides is that in the early days of the Vietnam War, the war itself was certainly not unpopular. And at least in terms of popular culture, books, movies, films, CDs, music, television shows, the Vietnam War gained acceptance by the people. Obviously something happens in the process and completely turns the American public against the war. Let's go to the next slide, please. All right, let's talk about another book. This is the reprinted version, the second and third edition of the famous book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, by Lieutenant Colonel, nicknamed Hal Moore, and Joseph Galloway, so forth like that. On the cover of this reprinted book is Mel Gibson, who played Moore, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore, in the epic battle of the Adrang Valley in November of 1965. Now, can I show this book now, Sean, if we can interrupt?
Yes, go ahead.
This is the original version of the book in 1992. On the cover of the book is a grunt, a rifleman carrying his M16 rifle with bayonet fixed. In my whole time in Vietnam, I never saw a bayonet fixed. I never got that close, nor did my troops ever get that close to the NVA that we needed the desperation message of a bayonet. And by the way, the M16 really wasn't a good rifle for the bayonet. The M1 was a good rifle for the bayonet. The M14 was a good rifle. They had weight. The M1 and the M14, if you think about it, even without ammunition, the rifle could be used as a weapon, as a club, as a launching post for a bayonet. When we took basic combat training, the spirit of the bayonet was to kill and the like. But I never saw an M16 mounted with the bayonet on it because I never got that close to the NVA, nor did my troops. We never ordered the use of it, but here is an unknown soldier carrying his M16 rifle in the heat of battle that close to the NVA that his company commander ordered fixed bayonets. I did not know who this unknown soldier was. as far as I knew, he's not wearing insignia. Most of us didn't have insignia with the jungle fatigues we got from the quartermaster laundry. So I did not know who it was, and most Americans did not know who it was. Anybody out there know who it was? His name, we learned after 9/11, was First Lieutenant Cyril, nicknamed Rick, Rescorla, R-E-S-C-O-R-L-A. Nicknamed by his men in his platoon, Hardcore. Born in Cornwall, England. Enlisted in the United States Army and gets commissioned from infantry officer school at Benning and comes to Fort Benning in Hal Moore, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore's 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, the same battalion I fought with about a year and a half after the Battle of the Ardrang and stuff like that. All right, what made Rick Rescorla a national hero? You remember the events of 9/11/01? Rick Rescorla, retired as an Army colonel in the reserves, was the director of security at Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley occupied the 44th through the 74th story of the South Tower. 2,700 people. They had another 1,000 people Morgan Stanley had in the North Tower. The director of security for Morgan Stanley, who had organized evacuation drills against the wishes of the millionaires and billionaires who ran Morgan Stanley, organized drills and so forth like that, Rick Rescorla was told by the Port Authority of New York, keep everybody in position up there, up the 44th through the 74th floor. Everybody in position. The North Tower is under attack. Keep everybody in position. Don't evacuate them. Rick Rescorla had practiced drills and so forth like that. And he said, no, that's not the way it's going to go. I'm going to evacuate these people. And he led them in columns of twos down the stairs. Elevators, of course, are out of contact. And 2,700 people were freed that day from the South Tower because of Lieutenant, in the book, Rick Rescorla and the like. He stayed on the phone to his wife, and he said, in effect, dear, he said, I'm doing what has to be done. This is a Cornishman. He leads these people down. He's got a bullhorn, and he's singing Cornish song that he learned in his youth. He sang some of them in Vietnam, too, by the way. And he leads these people, 2,700, down to safety. Six people died in the South Tower. All of the casualties were in the North Tower, which were hit first. Rick Rescorla, to make absolutely certain that everybody was evacuated from the South Tower, goes back into the building, which is now in process of collapsing, and somewhere on the 10th floor, the building just collapsed inwardly and crushed him. His remains have never been recovered. Next slide, please, Sean. There's a memorial to Rick Rescorla at the National Infantry Museum at Fort Benning, now Fort Moore. And this is me in front of an I-beam that the Fire Department of New York donated in memory of Rick Rescorla and his heroism on 9/11. The total casualties on 9/11 are just under 3,000, 29,060, something like that. That number would virtually have doubled if Rick Rescorla had not first organized drills, evacuation drills at Morgan Stanley against the better judgment of his bosses. And he had to fight with them about it. When Rick went back, Rick suffered from, he was grossly overweight because of the medications he had been taking. He was close to 300 pounds. He walked down and walked back up and the like. He was a true, true American hero, and it starts out with the cover of Soldier. We Were Soldiers Once and Young, but nobody knew who he was. All right, let's go to the next slide, please, Sean. When Kennedy took, by the way, these magazines that I'm showing you, I acquired them. Some of them cost him a couple of dollars because I wanted to illustrate the book with them. I thought that they could fit in. So when we talked about Kennedy, or we talked about LBJ, we talked about McNamara, we could show what they look like for people who are not necessarily, of course, everybody's familiar with Kennedy. This was the cover of the Saturday Evening Post after Kennedy accomplished his greatest foreign policy achievement, which was the Cuban Missile Crisis, the 13 days of October 1962, when, if you can read, Dean Rusk, Kennedy's Secretary of State, said, "We were eyeball to eyeball, and the other fellow just blinked. Khrushchev agreed to withdraw his forces, and we did not have a nuclear war, which the world has never come closer to nuclear war than the 13 days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Khrushchev had secretly sneaked nuclear missiles into Cuba and Soviet troops to train the Cubans in their use. It was the greatest victory for President Kennedy. Now we'll go to the next slide, please, Sean. When Westmoreland...
I'll interrupt real quick, Bob, just to mention that we may need to flash forward just a bit as we're going to hit up on our 8 o'clock station break here, but we'll get to the M16 and the misfiring. These are sort of a very condensed sort of history as we lead up into what problems caused this decision, these decisions to be made, right?
Sounds good.
Great.
I'll take a couple of minutes to talk about this one and be ready for your break.
Sure.
When Westmore, Creighton Abrams, Abe is one of my personal heroes. I will show you a slide of Abe and me when he visited my battalion at Fort Benning, Georgia. Abe was vice chief. Well, I'm not quite ready for that, but that's what it is. If we can come back to Abe, yeah. Abe was sent over to Vietnam to succeed Westmoreland as the top U.S. commander, as the leader. Abe was a West Point classmate of Westmoreland's class of 1936. Abe was America's really greatest fighting leader in World War II. He commanded the 37th Tank Battalion in Germany, Patton's Lee Tank Battalion, and George Patton once said, I'm supposed to be America's greatest tank, but I have but one peer, Abe Abrams. He is the greatest." So Abe came over to Vietnam to replace Westmoreland, and Westmoreland, for some reason not completely understood, was held over, whether it was because of the Tet Offensive had gone so badly and Westmoreland was being punished, or maybe LBJ saw Westmoreland as a possible presidential candidate and a threat to him in the 68 election. Nobody knows for sure, but Abe ultimately took over in June of 1968. And by that time, the country had turned against the war. The My Lai massacre, the Tet Offensive, American public said, they watched it on television, they saw Walter Cronkite, America's most trusted man, the CBS evening newsman, they saw Walter Cronkite say, after a visit to Vietnam, "A stalemate has taken place, the war cannot be won." Not everybody agreed with Cronkite. A lot of people disagreed with him, but the 20 million Americans who watched him that evening saw that there was no way to win the war, concluded that it was time to get out. And for that time, it was all downhill. So Abe takes over, and Vietnam, the word is Vietnamization. He Vietnamizes the program. He turns the fighting over to the Army of Vietnam, which should have been doing the fighting in the first place. But Westmoreland, among his other bad decisions, such as not giving the Arvin the M16 rifle, didn't want the Vietnam Army to take the lead in fighting first the Viet Cong and then subsequently the North Vietnamese Army. Westmoreland turned it into U.S. war. It should not have been a U.S. war. It should have been the South Vietnamese with U.S. assistance, with U.S. firepower, helicopters, artillery, all of these things. But Westmoreland insisted that the U.S. division would get the job done. Shall we go to the next slide, Sean, or do you want to take
Sure, I will. I'll take our station break right now. It's about 8 o'clock. For those of you joining us for the first time, this is the Veterans Breakfast Club. Our mission is to create communities of listening around veterans and their stories to connect educate, heal, and inspire. I'm going to bring up a little slideshow here just to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. They've been with us for quite some time. They are dedicated to preventing and reducing tobacco use and educating people about tobacco hazards and advocating for healthier places to live, work, and play. You can find out everything there is to know about Tobacco Free Adagio Health on their website, tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org. Also, we'd like to thank our new sponsor, UPMC for Life. They can help you make sense of Medicare. Get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans that can save you money and get you more benefits. You can view all their plan options by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. And we have a couple other announcements. This is our new magazine. This will be hitting the printer shortly. So you will be receiving this in the mail. Again, this is a free quarterly magazine. So if you don't receive it, it's because we don't have your address. Go ahead and send that to Todd at veteransbreakfastclub.org and send your address there. We'll make sure to get a magazine out to you. If you'd like a box of magazines, we print them out. We have a 500 issues in one box. Happy to send that to you. If you want to distribute them around your community, let them know about the VBC. This is the best way that we know to get the word out about our mission and what we do. There's also a survey that I will put into the chat here at the end of the program. If you'd like to take it, it's about 2.5 minutes. Let us know how we're doing. We always read these very closely. Thank you so much for joining us as well. And we are going to let you know that the scuttlebutt is sort of shifting. We talked a bit about at the beginning of the program how this is the VBC happy hour. It's been the VBC happy hour for quite some time. Well, the scuttlebutt is the podcast, pre-recorded podcast that I host. We've reached the end of the road for the scuttlebutt, sort of. I say that because this is the final episode that'll feature just me talking with a guest, usually a veteran or a veteran organization. Excuse me. I had a documentarian on, and I will put the link in the chat. He did a 5-part series, war movie, that you can get on Amazon Prime. It covers the entire American cinema of war films from 1900 to now. 5-part each an hour, incredible documentary series I got to watch. His name's Steve Summers. Evan Mulgrave, name that some of you may have remembered. He was the director of the BBC's own documentary, We Left as Brothers. He came on the program with me to interview Steve Summers, and we both got a chance to preview War Movie, all 5 parts. And I highly recommend it. I'm glad that, Bob, that you brought up Green Berets early in the program. They do talk about that during that series. Take a drink of water because I got a frog in my throat. Oh, excuse me. But I highly recommend this 5-part series. It was so in-depth and so interesting, and they cover so many of the movies that came out from, you know, from pre-sound all the way up until now. What the propaganda films were about in World War II, the Red Scare, what happened with Vietnam films and Korea films, why there weren't so many of them made. He brought on many experts, some of them from Pittsburgh because he has a Pittsburgh connection, Steve Summers. And he gets into the, you know, the like Black Hawk Down, a lot of the films that you saw now, like Jarhead or Hurt Locker, but everything from Casablanca, because he covers the idea of war movies in general, like overall, not just specific war movies like We Were Soldiers. So I highly recommend it. Again, I'll put that link in the chat and just go to the Amazon Prime, purchase it if you can, give it a watch. Also, check out the Scuttlebutt where we interview Steve Summers, maybe before or after you watch that series. Because like I said, see, last episode of this version of the Scuttlebutt, and what we're transitioning to is we're going to take these Monday night programs that we've been doing for quite some time, and we're going to release those as our Scuttlebutt. That'll be our new podcast. You can not only watch it here in the Zoom room live, but you can watch it on YouTube later if you miss our program on Monday night, or if you're going to go to the grocery store, you have to take a drive for work, you have to go walk on the treadmill, pop in your earbuds, and listen to what will be our Monday night program in audio format. So just different ways that you'll be able to engage with the Veterans Breakfast Club moving forward, as well as our Lioness podcast, which will continue. These will come out periodically, maybe once a month. Daria Summers, who we had on last week, she'll be coming back to continue on that as an audio format. Very excited to have Daria continue on with us to keep telling these incredible stories of these women who served in the post-9/11 wars. I had a couple of slides about pictures from different guns, but maybe, Bob, with our last 30 minutes together, I'd love to flash forward, if we can, to sort of the M16 and maybe sort of the development of it and what really went wrong. Do you think we can jump to that? Is there a part in your slide deck that we could jump to?
Look, may I just go very quickly through the next series of slides, Sean, and then I'll get into that, okay?
Sure. Let me bring up the slide deck here.
Very quickly.
There we are. Okay.
Through with that one.
Here we go.
Abrams, General Abrams, visiting my battalion at Fort Benning in the Volunteer Army. We were the 197 Brigade at Benning was the experimental all-volunteer Army unit. I later became spokesman in the Pentagon on the Volunteer Army, and I was spokesman when Abe took ill in April 1954 and on his death. After Abe died, I retired from the Army and went to work for the Miami Herald. Next slide.
Hold on one second. There we go.
Comparison in size between the NATO 7.62 round used in the M14 and 5.56 round used in the AR-15 and the M16 rifle. The rifleman could carry, the infantryman could carry 2.5 times as much ammunition of the 5.56 as he could for the 7.62. So that was a factor in the conversion to the M16. But here's a soldier carrying his M16. That bandolier around his neck contains the 20-round magazines, the magazines each of 20 round with his M16 rifle. Many soldiers found after their problems with the M16 that by not filling the magazine all the way to 20 round, but maybe 17 or 18 round, that they avoided some of the problem. Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't. We'll never know. Next slide. This maintenance manual on the M6, one of the problems with the M16 was soldiers were told and given a bill of goods by Colt and by the Army that the M16 was virtually maintenance free. And as a result, this manual, beautiful manual, doesn't get published until July of 1969. By July of 1969, we had more than half, we had 540,000 men in Vietnam. They never got this manual. I never saw that manual until I was home and away from Vietnam. So the men were convinced by Ford's, by Colt's propaganda that the rifle was self-cleaning, that it burned its bullets at such a high rate of speed that nothing fouled fouled the weapon. Obviously, that was propaganda, and the Army bought into it. Next slide. There's the M16 with its 20-round magazine. You're very, very familiar with that. Next one then, please, Sean. All right, let's go some of the problems with the M16. First of all, this weapon was not fully developed or tested. The Army, in effect, the Department of Defense, and led by the Air Force, General Curtis LeMay, was a major factor in bringing it into the military inventory. So he had some close connections with the Colt, close personal friendships with Richard Boutet-Botel, who was the head of Armalite, which developed the AR-15. The M16 was not fully developed or tested. It was committed into combat. We'll go to the next slide, please. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I should stay. I stay on that slide. Back one, please, Sean.
Sure.
I guess I'll stick with that. It went into combat. Its official designation. When the first cav, when the 173rd Airborne arrived with the M14, when the first cav arrived with the M14, when the advisors and the special forces arrived with their M16, it went into combat as XM16E1. What does that stand for? X meant the rifle was still in a developmental phase. It hadn't been standardized. The M14 had only been, M14E2 had only been standardized in 1959. This rifle is still in the developmental phase. The M stood for model. 16, the number 16 comes as a follow-on to the AR-15. Eugene Stoner, the brilliant Armalite and Colt developer, had gone from AR-1 to AR-15. The E in XM16E1 stands for experimental modification. And the one means its first modification. There were a total of 11 or 12 modifications subsequently made, and it was a bolt assist device. Next slide, please, Sean. So the first problem that we're talking about, not fully tested. Second problem, not necessarily in order, but in any order, this weapon was not ruggedized. It was off the shelf. The AR-15 wasn't necessarily developed by Stoner as a military weapon, so as a result, the rifle doesn't have chrome-plated chamber or bore, which was standard for all military weapon. And particularly when you're going through swamps such as this one and riverbeds, you've got to have chrome plating to resist against corrosion and rust. There was no need. Some people felt, one of the testimonies before the I-Corps committee, which I'll talk about, was that we didn't see a need to gold plate the rifle. It didn't need to be gold. It needed to be chrome plated. Next slide. I've already talked about this cold propaganda, which the Army incorporated into its training manual and FM-23-9. This rifle burns its ammunition so fast that it is self-cleaning. And as a result, not enough cleaning equipment accompanied the rifle to Vietnam. Next slide, please. There was insufficient cleaning equipment. For all of our previous weapons, there was a sturdy cleaning rod that you would shove down the bore of the rifle from the front in order to eliminate a stoppage or clear it, or sometime with a cleaning rod, cleaning pack at the end of the rod. The M16 came with a disassembled three-piece cleaning rod in a little pouch, and it was flimsy. It would break very, very easily. Well, the soldier had, if he was in close combat and he had a stoppage with his weapon and the doggone cleaning rod was disassembled in three pieces, he couldn't stop to assemble the cleaning rod. There are pictures of squad leaders getting killed, getting shot in the back while they're going down the front of their squad, the line of their squad, clearing the stoppages, the failure to extract, which was the major deficiency with it. So let's go on with our problem with the M16. Next slide, please, Sean. All right. Inadequate troop training. The 163rd, the Marines were the first. By the way, we just had the anniversary last Friday, March 8th. March 8th of 1965 is when the Marines, the 9th Marine Expeditionary Brigade from Okinawa, landed in Vietnam to take up the security around Tan Son Nhut Air Base. They came with their M14s, subsequently given M16, very little training, not enough maintenance equipment. The next unit, the 173rd Airborne Brigade, the Army, came from Okinawa, and the one they had just been given, the M16 rifle, and had a little bit more experience than the Marines. But basically, troops going over there had inadequate training, and again, were told a lie that this rifle is virtually self-cleaning. Next slide, please, Sean. Higher commanders realized, well, let's go back this way. Beginning in 1966, soldiers and Marines in Vietnam began writing home to their parents, and the parents wrote to the congressman saying, what kind of weapon has my son or husband been issued in Vietnam? It keeps breaking down, and soldiers are being killed, Marines are being killed, when their rifles jam in the thick of combat. The higher commanders blamed the troops on it. Inspectors went over and said these rifles are in an incredible state of rust. Well, the rifles were not as clean as they should have been. In previous rifles, the M14, the M1, there were looser tolerances, but the M16 was a finicky little varmint gun. And the result is if it got dirty, and because of the wrong ammunition, which we'll come to in a minute, it tended to get dirtier, the weapon jammed, and it failed to extract. The Marine generals in particular were savage with their troops and fired commanders left and right because their troops weren't cleaning the weapons properly. That wasn't the problem. It may have been a small part of the problem. The troops didn't have enough cleaning equipment and had to ride home for lubricants and rifle patches and a good bore cleaner. But let's go to the next slide, please, Sean. Colts had been having labor problems, financial problems, and the result is that a lot of M16s slipped through without adequate supervision, either by Colt's own engineers or by the military officers, the Army officers, who were supposed to be supervising it. So not all of the M16s that came were really in grade A firing condition. Next slide, please, Sean. The Army came up with some really inane specifications and kept changing them as it evolved from the AR-15 to the XM-16 and so forth like that. The Army kept changing the fact that it wanted, the Army said it, we need to have a muzzle velocity of 3,250 per second and the like. Well, it didn't have to be that fast. And Colt had problems getting up to that speed. The Army said, the rifle has got to be, remember we're talking about a varmint rifle with a small 223 round. The Army said, the rifle, the ammunition, has got to be able to penetrate a steel helmet at 500 yards. First of all, the enemy didn't wear steel helmets. The VC didn't wear any helmets at all. They fought bareheaded in their black pajamas, and the NVA fought in green khaki uniforms with green pith helmets made of some form of plastic. There were no steel helmets that needed to be penetrated. We never saw the enemy at 500 yards. You saw the enemy like that when Rick Briscola with his bayonet. You saw the enemy at 100 yards or at most 300 yards. So the Army kept insisting that the rifle's got to perform like on a World War II battlefield, steel helmet at 500 yards, when that was not necessary. Next slide, please. Each time you take an engine on anything you can think of, take your automobile engine. Each time you make a change in its design, an after action, a reaction takes place. Newton's law of physics, you know, every action creates a reaction. So each time the Army insisted on changes being made to the M16, whether it was the rifling change, of course, the ammunition we'll talk about, whether it was a rifling change, whether it was firing pin change, each time a change was made, some subsequent after action takes place, and these were not tested. And that McNamara's number two in his the Department of Defense, Roscoe Gilpatrick, said, we don't need additional training. We don't need initial testing and so forth like that. The Army has been dragging its heels too long on this. And in fact, some of that was true. The Army was dragging its heels because the Army didn't see the M16 as a viable long-term firing weapon. The Army had in mind what it called a SPU, a special purpose individual weapon, which would replace the M14 and the M14E2. The M14E2 was the full automatic fire version of the M14, which was a semi-automatic rifle. The problem with the M14E2 was it was too heavy, and the problem was it was hard to control in its full automatic setting. An infantry rifle squad consisted of 11 men. Two fire teams, a five men each, plus a squad leader. One man in each fire team carried an M14E2 with full automatic capability. The other four men in each fire team had M14s with only semi-automatic. That was the weapon, by the way, which most of the Army men and Marines went into in Vietnam, the M14 with the M14E2. As we saw, with certain exception to airborne and air mobile units, special forces units, everybody went in with M14, quickly given M16, in which they had little or no training, were told it was self-cleaning and the like, and so forth. So these developmental modifications were just not properly tested because the Defense Department was rushing a kind of stubborn Army, which really didn't want the M16, was rushing. And finally, McNamara's men said, the heck with the Army. We're not going to do any more developmental testing. We'll standardize the M16 and issue it to everybody in Vietnam. Meanwhile, our forces in Europe continued to be with the M14, as did forces in the United States. Next slide, please, Sean. The rifle had a tendency to jam. Why did it have a tendency to jam? Because mainly there were several other reasons. But it was dirty. There was not enough cleaning equipment. The chrome plating should have been done on the bore in the chamber. But most prevalent among the reasons for tendency to jam was the fact that the wrong ammunition was being used for it. Let's go to the next slide, please. Failure to extract was the result of the fact that the weapon, when it was tested, when it was developed as the AR-15 and tested by the Army in its initial firing test, it used a gunpowder called IMR, Improved Military Rifle Powder. replacing the ball powder which had been used in the M14 and the M14E2. The IMR was actually not a newer powder, it was an older powder dating back to the early 20th century. The AR-15 and the XM16 were all tested using correct powder, IMR. We can go to the next slide, please. The ball versus IMR. All of the testing in the United States and even in the weapon, in the initial 1,000 weapon, which was sent to Vietnam for experimentation, used the correct powder, IMR, which had no problems in jamming and failing to extract. When you use the wrong powder, which is what was subsequently issued to the troops, because one, the IMR was too expensive, two, the ammunition manufacturers couldn't keep up with the demand for it, and three, there was a whole lot of ball powder available in the inventories at the Army arsenals and manufacturers, so forth like that. So ultimately, people go around, our weapons experts go round and round on what was the problem with the M16 and to whether the wrong ammunition was a contributing factor. Chan participated, as I said earlier, my co-author participated in the development of the weapon, and he knew that it functioned well when the IMR powder was used, and he also knew that when the wrong powder was substituted, all kinds of problems could result. The net result was, let me read to you what a learned observer wrote about our problems in Vietnam to sum up, because we're almost out of time, and I want to see if we have any questions. A man named C.J. Chivers is currently a writer for the New York Times Magazine. He was a Marine captain in Iraq, went through the Army Ranger course, and wrote a book called The Gun, which quite often in our book, wrote a book called The Gun about the various assault weapons which were used by various nations and the like. Here's what Chivers wrote in an article in Esquire magazine in 2010. It's so well worded that I wish Chan and I had written it. The early M16 and its ammunition formed a combination not ready for war. They were a flawed pair emerging from a flawed development history. Prone to malfunction, they were forced onto troops. They were forced onto troops' hands through a clash of wills and egos in Robert McNamara's Pentagon. Instead of a thoughtful progression from prototype to general issue arms, the M16's journey was marked by salesmanship. I want to get a little bit more light on this. Was marked by salesmanship, chicanery, incompetence, and no small amount of dishonesty by a manufacturer and senior military officers. Its introduction in use was briefly heralded as a triumph of private industry and perceptive management. It swiftly became a monument to the hazards of hubris and the perils of rushing a study in military management gone awry. That pretty well sums up what the problems were with the M16. The process of rushing the M16 into combat without adequate testing, with the wrong ammunition, without adequate cleaning equipment, without adequate troop training, without a chrome-plated bore and chamber, all of those things added up to a disaster. Now, Chan and I entitled our book, The Tragedy of the M16 Rifle in Vietnam, The Tragic Failure of the M16 in Vietnam. It is interesting to speculate that if Kennedy had not been assassinated, Kennedy, with his fondness for special operations, for counterinsurgency operations, Kennedy, with his early fixation on the M16 rifle, one of his aides, Major General Clifton, showed Kennedy an early version of the M16. It's interesting to speculate that if Kennedy, who saw how a counterinsurgency should be fought, had remained as president, instead of ultimately what happened, where Lyndon Johnson wanted to favor guns and butter and his great society, it's interesting how the outcome might have been different. I tried to show you in this presentation how a winnable war, a very winnable war, which the public ardently supported in its culture in the early days of the war, 1995, 1996, 1997, turned against the war really beginning in 1968. The Tet Offensive, which began on the last day of February and continued through most of February, Americans looked at what's going on that TV screen and said, what the heck is happening? Westmoreland was home, talked to Congress, said we're winning the war and we're grinding the enemy down. Where did they come from? Now, we won the battle of the Tet Offensive on the battlefield. The United States, by the way, we had 40 allies in Vietnam, which most people don't realize. Not all of them fighting men. The West Germans sent a hospital ship, the Helgoland, for example. The Thais had a Royal Thai Company from Thailand. Australia had very capable aircraft squadrons and the like. But, so there were 40 allies working with us, but it, basically the fighting was done. Oh, the South Koreans. The South Koreans had two very fine combat divisions, which was so savage that they were accused of war crimes in the way they treated Viet Cong and NVA prisoners. All of these things conspired. 1968, of course, was a terrible year in the United States. The Tet Offensive, LBJ, Walter Cronkite, getting on national television and saying the war is unwinnable. The United States did the honorable thing, Cronkite said, but now it's time to say, to leave honorably and to say we did our best and our best was not enough. Then in June, Bobby Kennedy, younger brother of Jack Kennedy, was assassinated. MLK was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. My battalion was sent from Fort Carson, Colorado, to help quell the rioting in Washington, D.C. The Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August 1968 turned in anti-war. And for all of those reasons, a war that should have been won was certainly not won. Whether we were defeated or not depends on which historian you want to consult. Sean, back to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Bob. I think, Jim, you may be pointed out, you may be the most experienced in the room here with the M16. I thought you might comment on your experience with the M16. And I agree with you, the question basically of, did anybody, the Ordnance Corps, did anybody high up who fixed a lot of these tests, did anybody pay for these fixings, for the lies that were told?
Can I answer that, Sean?
Yeah, go ahead.
A congressional subcommittee was sent to Vietnam, three men, the I-Corps committee. One of its findings was that Major General Nelson Lind, at one point the commanding general of the Army Materiel Command, upon his retirement, went to work for Colts as a consultant, a paid consultant. Lind is the one, L-Y-N-D-E, Lind is the one who had approved the initial contract with Colts for the AR-50/XM-16E1 and so forth like that. The I-Corps committee said if that wasn't, it said at the very least it was a conflict of interest. At the very most, it was a criminal offense. Did he pay for it? No.
Thanks, Bob. Jim, I'll go back to the original question of what was your experience with the M16?
I outlined it in the chat, and I asked the question, did anyone pay for it? And I agree with the comments that everyone that died paid for that price. By 1971, I guess the problems have been worked out. We still maintain, we did carry a little more than 200 rounds because our thinking was the weapon would jam after 200 rounds. And in our situation, if we needed more 200 rounds, we were in deep doo-doo anyway, probably more rounds wouldn't help. But we were taught, we were taught in AIT and OCS that the weapon had to be just kept incredibly clean. Would be nice to keep it dry, but that's kind of impossible in that environment. But we were always cleaning the weapons. That was just standard as far as that's concerned. And I never got into a case to where I had to expend full 200 rounds. So I never had that kind of jam problem with the weapon. But the Vietnamese troops I was with, these were the popular forces in the village. They had just been issued the M16s, and we had a hard time keeping them to keep the weapons clean. As far as cleaning kits were concerned, we had enough cleaning kits for us. I'm not sure the popular forces did, as far as that's concerned. It was something we were cautious about and concerned about, but there was nothing we could do about it.
Bob Plage, you have your hand up?
Yes, sir. As an infantry grunt, I was assigned to the 9th Infantry Division, and lo and behold, I ended up in a combat support company. Originally, I was a team leader for 106 Jeep Mounted Rifle. When they created the Mobile Riverine Force, they took they took all our toys away from us, and we became straight leg. And at the time, I became a squad leader. And every time we deployed, came back to the ships, I made sure everybody cleaned their weapons before they got undressed. We got hosed down by the Navy with their fire hoses, get all the mud off us, and we immediately went and cleaned weapons. Unless they had chow sitting there hot waiting for us, weapons were cleaned. And, so I have no disagreement with Bob's, what he said about the weapons, needed to be cleaned, et cetera. The one disagreement I have is if he was with us February 26, 27, he would have seen a lot of bayonets on those rifles. At about 12 o'clock, we got overrun, and we could see them from my position. We had to do an assault through a rice paddy. Bravo Company got, whacked up going into a hot LZ, and the choppers wouldn't come back, so we had to hoof it in. My platoon was told to go ahead and, commandeer the other side, and we did fire and maneuver to get over there. And we had fire, introductory fire for us. When we called the ceasefire, that's when they came back, and we could see them moving from one bunker to the next. And the company commander was directly opposite my position on the other side of the rice paddy. And about 2 o'clock, we could hear people behind us, but they never came over our berm. We were in a, behind them. It was a banana grove behind us. But we, about 2 o'clock, I had my platoon fix bayonets because we were afraid those guys were going to come over because they got all the way down within one bunker of the company commander. I lost my 79 man. He got killed, and I used his weapon trying to use it as a mortar, shooting up and lobbing them over the rice paddy. But they had taken our 60 from us at one point, and every time a rifle would fire across the rice paddy, they would fire the 60 down our line. So we had to hold off on that. But like I said, we never had to use them, but they were there and they were fixed.
Jim Roberts.
Now, just going to the fact with the cleaning, when I was always out with an E7, my captain was always out with an E6. When we'd come back from an operation, we'd drop our packs and gear at the door to the hut and go in and take a shower. And by the time we'd come back out, our weapons had been cleaned. The captain and the E6 had cleaned my weapon and my sergeant's. And when they came back in, we'd clean their weapons. It was the first thing you worried about was keeping the weapon clean. It was more important than cleaning yourself. And we just gave each other a break so we could get into a shower because we were usually pretty rotten by the time we came back in.
Yeah, I had faith in my weapon. I don't recall ever having a misfire. However, I did carry, I had my own personal 1911 that I had sent over from family, and I carried that with me also. But like I said, I never had misfire, and I can't recall any of our guys, losing, not having be able to fire their weapon. I did get, one time we were moving through a hostile village, and I grabbed a 16-year-old. I was leading there. And all of a sudden, somebody opened up on us, and I rolled over into a ditch in a banana grove, and I was holding my weapon above my, with my elbows in the mud, and I'm just gradually sinking, and I'm saying, oh my God, I don't want this thing to go underwater. I don't, but fortunately it didn't. Anyway.
Thank you, Bob. Robert, I want to direct people to your book, Misfire. What is the, if people were to reach out and pick up the book, what is the one thing you really hope that they gain from your book, Misfire?
58,300 American young men gave their lives in fulfillment of a U.S. military, of U.S. Governmental policy, the containment of communism. That was the stated foreign policy of the United States throughout the Cold War. The containment of communism going to Vietnam was consistent with that foreign policy. We're going, in our going to Vietnam, the intent was correct. The way we went about it was all wrong. And the 58,300 names that are on the Vietnam Wall didn't die in vain. They fought for their country, but the end should have been a happier one than it was. That's my message.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for coming on the program tonight. We will be back, of course, next Monday night, 7 p.m. Eastern time, with more military topics, more stories, and more of the great BBC programming that you all come to enjoy. Thank you all for a lively chat tonight. Thank you, Bob, again, for the history lesson and for talking to us about the M16. And for your book, Misfire, please reach out. Check it out there. There is links in the chat. Anybody that has any questions, please feel free to reach out to me, Sean, S-H-A-U-N, at veteransbreakfastclub.org. I wish you all a very happy evening. Thank you. Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health. Tobacco-Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco-Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco-Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.